Hey, we're about to get to our show, but first I wanted to give you a quick word from our sponsor, Lynda. Lynda is a great way to learn just about anything. It's already February. If you've made some New Year's resolutions to pick up some new skills, this is the time to invest in yourself. They've got over 3,000 courses, all taught by experts. Millions of people around the world take them. They've got everything from basic stuff like Excel, WordPress, and Photoshop to, I was just checking out the audio software Logic, which I'd love to learn. JavaScript for web designers would definitely help me out. Anyway, whether you want to set new financial goals, find a work and life balance, find a new hobby, ask your boss for a raise, whatever you're trying to do in 2015, Lynda.com has something for you. So I want you to go to Lynda, Lynda.com/longform and sign up for a 10-day free trial. This is for our listeners. You'll get unlimited access to every course on Lynda.com, even if you're on your phone, wherever. Watch the videos, learn something new. Go ahead. I challenge you. Thank you, Lynda.com. Here we are with the show. Hey, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer here with Longform's Max Linsky and the Atavist's Evan Ratliff. Good morning, guys.
Hey, guys.
Good afternoon. A bit of a sad day around our offices. A really good friend to all the people, many of our guests and the hosts of this show, David Carr, passed yesterday. He was a huge voice in what we think about this thing that we're doing, and also just a all-around great talker.
Yeah, there's so many tributes to him right now, and that happens anytime someone dies. But from even knowing him a little bit, I mean, it's all true. Like the generosity, the influence that he had, over me and what we do, and, you know, just like profound effect, everything from introducing us to people to just like the way he was generous with his time, or like open to what was, you know, being interested in something that he didn't need to be interested in, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like all three of us didn't spend a ton of time with him, but he had this huge impact on all of us. And one of those things is that he you wanted to do well in his eyes. Like, you know, you wanted to impress him. And really early on, I called dibs on the David Carr interview for the podcast. And then it took me a long time to get up the nerve to actually ask him to do it. And I finally did recently. And we were actually scheduled to do it last night. And then he pushed it because he had to interview Edward Snowden. And I wish I got the chance to do that.
Well, it's a loss for the whole community of journalism and readers, and obviously to his family. And for this week's episode, I think at least we have a kind of appropriate guest. We have someone from the Times. David loved the Times more than anyone, and he loved a great reporter and storyteller. So, Aaron, who'd you have on?
And someone who could ask tough questions. I was just watching some clips of him. Like, there's no one I've ever seen who's like more like willing to go straight for the like uncomfortable question than he was. So, my guest is also someone who asks a lot of uncomfortable questions. I'm sorry, this episode starting on kind of like a low swell of energy, which is actually one of my favorite episodes. One of the best interviews I've ever had. The chance to speak to someone. My guess is Rukmini Kalamaki. And it's not maybe a name that our entire audience would know, but you've definitely read her work this year. I don't think anyone's been on the front page of the New York Times more. She's only been working at the Times for 10 months, I believe. But she was brought in to be what's basically their ISIS correspondent. Not just ISIS, I guess, sort of that entire world of terror groups correspondent. And she wrote the story about James Foley and the other captives, captivity in Syria. She wrote the story about the Kouachi brothers in Paris.
That story was unbelievable.
Both those stories
a couple days after.
Yeah. She like flew to Paris immediately and did that story, you know, not really having contacts in Paris, you know, by herself, more not by herself, other people helped. I shouldn't say that, but these are like really big stories. Like these are the stories that are like framed on people's, you know, wall kind of stories. And she's done many of them in less than a year. And she has a really interesting story of how she got there. She is not, she's not like a journalism superstar who's always been winning prizes. She was on a local desk in Illinois not that many years ago. She was born in Romania and left. Her story is really fascinating. It's so fascinating, actually, that So I came in at 5 to talk to her, and I had a dinner plan at 7:30, and the clock crossed 7:30, and I had to cancel that dinner via text message because we were still going. So we talked for over 3 hours.
A new record.
Yeah. quality and quantity. And we're actually going to put this out as a two-part episode. So this is part one. We'll have part two out soon. Like, we're trying to get out as soon as we can get it edited. We're working rapidly here. Please check them both out. They are both interesting and quite different and about different parts of what she does.
Do we have any sponsors this week?
We do. We do. I don't know if you guys have been itching to send a newsletter, but if you do, I suggest you do it with Tiny Letter. It's a simple, elegant way to send an email newsletter. It is done by the good people at MailChimp who continue to support this show, and we thank them for it.
Now here's Aaron with Rukmini.
Welcome, Rukmini Kalamaki.
Thank you for having me.
I'm surprised that this interview is happening because I woke up this morning and you had a cover story on the front of the New York Times today about ISIS reporting that the lone female hostage had died in a Jordanian airstrike.
Yes, I came to the office yesterday expecting to have, you know, sort of a quiet Friday, and was planning actually to do my expenses. And I can't remember exactly when. I think it was halfway through the morning. A colleague sent me a tweet from an Islamic State linked account where they were showing pictures of this flattened building and naming Kayla Mueller, who's this hostage whose name and whose story I've known since at least the middle of last year. And we've closely guarded her name and her details at the request of her family, who had been told by ISIS that if they named her in any way, if they went to the press in any way, that they would kill her. And all of us were really praying and hoping that she might be the exception. You know, it seemed when they started killing James Foley and the others and the men, it just seemed like it was this inevitable wave.
Yeah.
But there was always a question about the woman. You know, would they go so far as to kill a woman? And this was an ending that I had not anticipated. We don't know if it's true that she died in a Jordanian airstrike, but it, in a way, avoids answering this question. Is ISIS willing to kill a Western woman by at least claiming that she's been killed in this airstrike?
I want to talk about several parts of that story. So how does this kind of, you said a friend told you that this was happening on sort of ISIS Twitter channels, these reports. How do you gauge whether something is newsworthy like that? I mean, I guess I'm wondering, when do you know to pull the trigger and say, okay, this has to go in the New York Times now, as opposed to we were holding it, when the source of the information is Twitter?
So let me answer it in two ways. First of all, the Islamic State and also the various branches of Al-Qaeda have a very specific way of communicating with the outside world. Mm-hmm. They all have these publishing arms. In the case of ISIS, there's several of them, but perhaps the most important is called Al-Furqan. They also have an official radio station and an official English language magazine. And so these messages are usually generated by the publishing arm, and then it gets released on Twitter by what we call ISIS-linked accounts. And those accounts are, I can't even keep track of them because they're constantly being taken down. So in my case, what I've done is I've been able to nurture a couple of sources that are very close to the Islamic State. I wouldn't go so far as to call them ISIS members because I don't actually know who they are, but they clearly have access to this material immediately before it's even published on social media. And these people will usually send me a message and say, hey, look, this thing is out there. And you can then tell, first of all, it has the branding, you know, of this arm of ISIS, whether it's Al-Furqan, etc. you can also tell from just the look of it. And certainly for the hostage videos, I'm sure you saw that James Foley's execution and Stephen Sotloff's execution and Peter Kasich's, they were all mostly the same scenario. You know, the hostage is there in an orange jumpsuit. They're kneeling in a desertscape, which various experts have identified as the hills around Raqqa and in that general area. And there's this man that we've now started dubbing and calling Jihadi John, who's always the same executioner. And it has a pattern. And once you start seeing, it's almost like the DNA of these videos. When you've seen them enough times, it's very jarring when you see something that is not by them. You know, and so when the ones that are not by them come across your screen, you're like, you just hold off. So it's almost the kind of visual anthropology that we've been forced to do. We then have a checks and balances. The Site Intelligence Group, run out of Washington, has for years now become sort of a clearinghouse of these jihadi messages. They track everything. And they have people that are embedded with these jihadi groups that are at least very much in contact with them. And when they, I will usually get these messages an hour or so before Site puts it out. But when Site puts it out and Site says, this is an ISIS-linked account, or this is by the publishing arm of ISIS, I then feel, at that point, I usually feel comfortable enough, to go with it. Then the big question becomes, how much of this do we put out? And in the case of the New York Times, we put out not even, I think, 1%, of what these people are publishing, because there's a very big debate about what the balance is between news and propaganda.
Yeah.
Every one of these execution videos is propaganda for these groups. At the same time, you cannot avoid that, the death of a young woman who's now been held for 17 months or so, who happens to be American and from Arizona, that isn't news in our country.
And additionally, you can't deny that if this is on ISIS Twitter accounts, this is clearly going to be in the Jordanian media.
Exactly.
This is a story that is not going to stay in the bag because the New York Times specifically makes that choice. Does that make it hard for you to really pull the brakes at all, knowing that there are other people who have this access to the same material?
I think we make our decision pretty independently. There's been several ISIS videos that have come across my desk. For instance, the ones that involve John Cantley, the hostage who's allegedly been turned and is now essentially shooting propaganda videos for ISIS. We did the first one. I think we did maybe a mention of the second one, but we're just not going to put out every single one of them. I often will sometimes get emails, from editors when they'll see that some ISIS video is being, reported on by the Daily Beast. Should we have that? Should we not have that?
Yeah.
For instance, there was one where we had kind of an internal discussion about it. Was a video that showed a young kid, he looked like he was 11 or 12, standing with a man, and the man essentially shows him how to execute a hostage. It's a local hostage. It's not one of the foreigners. And I had been seeing a buildup of these children-related videos, pictures of training camps that show children, pictures showing little kids decapitating their dolls. And there had been sort of a constant wave of it. So when the actual video of a child or a prepubescent, kid killing somebody finally emerged, to me it wasn't news. I think I actually erred in that. There is something very different between showing a training camp,
right,
and showing an actual child carrying out an act of atrocity. But anyway, so we have these discussions all the time, and we're trying to be, sensitive to the fact that this is exactly what they want. Every single time we write about one of these executions, it's what they want.
Yeah. So, one of the things that interests me about this is what you're dealing with when you're dealing with this publicity apparatus, I think, is really like an advanced public relations machine. It's something that's generally associated more with a government than with a terrorist group. Mm-hmm. And prior to covering ISIS, and I think you continue to cover Al-Qaeda,
yeah,
so is having this kind of direct sort of professional level exchange with people, is this new, or is this a tactic that's been adapted from previous groups?
It's new for me. For me, the change began to occur when I was living in Africa. I was in Senegal for almost 8 years, and I was there coincidentally, at a time that paralleled the arc of the rise of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, which at one point became probably the most lucrative branch of Al-Qaeda because of their kidnapping for ransom business. And from December 2006, when I arrived there, until I would say 2012, which is when they took over half of northern Mali, it was a very frustrating beat. You know, I felt like I was just regurgitating the same information. I would go to the same diplomats, the same analysts who said the exact same thing. After a while, I started wondering if they actually had any information. You know, I just felt like we were in this echo chamber of, you know, saying the same facts about this group. And everything changed for me, I would say, in the middle of 2012, when Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, in a way that very much prefaced what ISIS has now done in Raqqa and in Syria and Iraq, established an Islamic state. Not a caliphate, but like an Islamic area of control in this very large territory that they controlled. It was actually the size of Afghanistan when we looked at the square footage of it. And they began acting like a government. They set up a Sharia court, a tribunal. They had police officers that went around ticketing people for various perceived offenses. They issued a speed limit in the city of Timbuktu. Timbuktu is covered with sand. And so it's actually quite hard to drive fast, you know, in Timbuktu. But they issued a speed limit anyway. And among the things they did is they appointed a spokesperson for their local affiliate, which was called Ansardin. And I, at this point in time, somehow, I can't even remember how, I got the phone number of one of their commanders, a guy called Umar Ul-Tamaha. And at first, I was one of probably two dozen or more reporters that would call him. And I don't want to flatter myself, but I think I somehow struck almost a kind of friendship with him. It sounds very weird to say that. So it started with... first, I would call him once a week, then I'd call him twice a week, then three times a week. And, you know, in the course of things, you know, you would call him and he would call me back and I'd say, I'm so sorry, Umar Ul-Tamaha, you know, I've got to take a call from my mom. The next time he would call and he'd say, Rukmini, how's your mom? Anyway, so this sort of wall between the terrorist and the journalist right. began to sort of erode. And not to make light of it, but on a human level, you connect with another human being. You know, I got to know personal things about him. He started to become a very good source. I mean, there was never one moment in time that I can point to where he actively lied to me. And in fact, there were many things he said to me that I did not believe. For one of them, a very big one, was he told me that they had surface-to-air missiles, and he said it was the SA-7A and SA-7B surface-to-air missile.
These are the missiles you can shoot down a commercial
aircraft. Exactly. And this was a very big deal in Mali at this point in time because the Gaddafi regime had just imploded. Gaddafi's arsenal of some of the most sophisticated weapons was essentially, you know, lying open for anybody to steal. And there was a lot of chatter and a lot of worry that Al-Qaeda's branch in northern Africa would get their hands on it. And African airports are a complete joke in terms of security. So it's not out of the ordinary or out of the realm of possibility that they could have shot down, you know, a Western.
It's like infiltrating a parking lot,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't report it because, I mean, how can I report something so significant on the word of, you know, an admitted terrorist? And fast forward to January of 2013, the French launch a massive intervention when they realized that this, you know, what we saw in Syria was essentially happening in Mali and was getting worse. And they pushed back the Islamists out of northern Mali, and reporters, you know, flooded in. And so I was able to get to the city of Timbuktu just a few days after it was liberated. And, you know, in the course of my reporting, I started asking people, so, okay, where did you see them? What buildings did they use? And in the course of doing that, I ended up going to the various structures that they had occupied. And in these buildings, I found thousands of pages of documents that they left behind because they left kind of in a hurry.
Right.
And among the first things that I found was a stack of manuals for the SA-7A and SA-7B surface-to-air missile, detailed instructions on how to put in the various parts, how to protect it from the elements, and how to shoot down a plane. And I'll never forget. I hired a translator in Timbuktu who wasn't very good. He was just like this local local kid. And he came over to, you know, to my hotel, and we were sitting there, you know, by this weak light, trying to read this manual. And the first page was written in Arabic. It had a picture of the missile, which I didn't recognize. And he's translating for me, and I see SA-7, right? And he's translating for me surface to air, which in French he said was une bombe sur la terre et dans l'air, which literally translates as a bomb on the ground and in the air.
Accurate.
And I'm like, you know, and I'm like, what do you, a bomb on the ground and in the air, a bomb in the ground. And I'm like, oh, surface to air? Yeah, yeah, surface to air. And I'm like, oh my God, it's a surface to air missile, you know.
Right.
And then he opened it. It's SA-7A, SA-7B. And anyway, so it was, for me, it was the turning of a new leaf when I realized that, you know, we seem to think that because they're terrorists and they do the worst thing possible, you know, yeah, which is killing civilians, that therefore they must also be liars. And certainly some of them are, and certainly they exaggerate, and certainly they say things that are untrue sometimes. But it's been my experience that if you manage to touch the leadership or people that are in the circumference of the leadership, and if you create sort of a system for talking to them, that they can be reliable sources.
Well, it seems like almost that assuming that groups are liars, it's sort of a comforting assumption,
right?
Because it suggests that everything is bluster and that it's purely propaganda. It's not strategy. But right, in that same dump of stuff that you found in Timbuktu,
yes,
and this is the reporting you did for the AP, and
for
this
the
was
AP
in 2013,
yes,
which you won a Pulitzer for.
No, I was a finalist.
Which you finalized.
I wish I'd won the Pulitzer for.
Like on this show, you won the Pulitzer, which you were nominated for a Pulitzer on.
Yeah.
There was a trove of documents that basically outlined an al-Qaeda strategy for the establishment of a state. And the stuff in it isn't like, let's kidnap people and torture them. It's basically like, people love trash collection. If you can nail trash collection, you've got them. And
totally.
It's quite mundane.
Yep.
And it suggests very much an organized strategy for creating a state.
Absolutely.
And what it seems to me like is in reporting this stuff, journalists are sort of on the vanguard of, in some ways, treating these groups like a state. I mean, once you sort of have the knowledge, okay, they want to create a state, they want to be treated like a state, right, by journalists. Right. Where is that, like, is there a validation in like treating them that way? And how do you sort of measure, like, you know, if Maghreb says, I want to be known as President Maghreb from now on in the Times,
right,
like, who makes that call? Because the U.S. government is going to be quite late on,
yeah,
recognizing them as a state.
Right.
But at some point, certain people will.
Right, right. So linguistically, we're kind of in a bind with ISIS because they've very cleverly chosen the name for themselves of the Islamic State, right?
Yeah.
And so at the New York Times, our style right now is on first reference, we qualify it. So we say the militants of the so-called Islamic State.
Right.
Or Islamic State extremists said, blah,
right,
blah, blah. But you can't do that on every, like, second, third. The AP is actually doing that, where on,
yeah,
second, third, fourth,
oh,
fifth,
really,
reference, they still say Islamic State militants.
It's hard to get in, like, a headline,
yeah,
too, you know? It's like,
exactly,
if you're going to cut space, that's
exactly,
the, like, so-called goes,
exactly,
so easily.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, you get in trouble on the second or third reference, but, you know, we're right now using, like, a host of linguistic tools to try to signal to readers that we obviously don't think that this is a real state.
Right.
However, the reporting on the state-like functions of ISIS and of al-Qaeda, which up until quite recently were, I think, ignored by most journalists. And I remember when I was at the AP and I wanted to do, I actually pitched a story about, you know, their state-like behavior in Mali. There was a lot of resistance and a lot of, you know, worry on the part of my editors that we were somehow falling for their propaganda.
Yeah.
It's my opinion that we need to just kind of grapple with this. Among the most interesting documents that I found in Timbuktu and that I've really not been able to exploit yet because they're, in a way, they're so old, but it was the records of the tribunal. And this is the Sharia court where, when I was reporting this on the phone in 2012, the only thing that we would report on is when they passed one of the so-called hudud, issued one of the hudud punishments. Hudud is the big punishments, the stoning to death of an adulterous couple, the amputation of hands, the execution of an alleged murderer, you know, because these things are so horrific for us, mm-hmm, and so visceral. In fact, the vast majority, and I have, you know, hundreds of pages of these tribunal notes, and the vast majority of the cases are very petty social disputes. And I suddenly realized that what was happening is Mali has a broken justice system. It always has. It's West Africa, one of the poorest regions in the world. Magistrates, court officials are accused of being corrupt, and people believe that, you know, that they can't have their day in court, so why even go? And I came across land disputes, you know, people that had, you know, like this guy comes in and says, since 1971, I was given this parcel by my father. In 1975, this itinerant, you know, herdsman came and built a hut on the edges of my property. The next year, he started planting sorghum plants on one lane of my property. The second year, he added another line. And, you know, he describes how this thing just encroached on him and how, you know, this is his land and he's got a deed, and the guy keeps on saying, but no, but I also have rights to it. And they would come, and the impression that I got is that on non-sexual things and things outside of the realm of what, you know, of these Sharia punishments that we find quite gross, that on these simple things, that they felt that they were getting more justice in this particular al-Qaeda court. And that's a very scary thing to ponder. Yeah. What al-Qaeda and what ISIS does is they burrow in places that are broken, you know, in places where there's a vacuum. And sadly, there's some things that they do well.
Sure.
Sadly.
These things sort of echo other stories you've heard before. So for me, when you say that, it echoes. I remember the... Misha Glennie wrote a book called McMafia that's basically about how organized crime mm-hmm. occupies a vacuum when the state leaves. Like, you have a bunch of trained soldiers. If everyone pulls out, some order presents itself. And a lot of people say, hey, like, these guys, you know, they take 10% of my business, but, like, there's no violence here anymore. And they, like, no one steals because they'll kill them. And, like, that's almost something that we've seen in the world before, but it seems so radical that we've gone from al-Qaeda to something like that in really only a handful of years. I mean, one thing that's always interested me about your reporting is what I know about al-Qaeda is heavily from, like, Looming Tower, like Lawrence Wright's book.
Fantastic.
Which is a fantastic book, but it's written in retrospect. Yeah. So it's saying, looking backwards, it's pretty clear that al-Qaeda's plan was to lure the West into occupations that would prove unpopular and get them out of the region. Yeah. It's not a very hard case to make now. What are the challenges of sort of telling this evolving story in real time as you go?
Well, for me, it got interesting, and this really only became my beat, I would say, in 2012 and 2013, when I finally was able to start having primary sources. A, being able to talk to a handful, you know, of these guys. Umar al-Tumaha was sadly killed. Not sadly, but, you know, he was killed. And then I could never, and this wonderful source I had was suddenly gone. I also had these documents, you know, that I started, that I spent months, really like a year, working with a translator and trying to understand. And what I suddenly realized is that there's something much more complex here. You know, it's an actual philosophy. It's a murderous one. It's a very dangerous and awful one in one respect. But it's not just this cartoonish, you know, thing that I had been led to believe. And I try to bring that perspective in the stories that I do. The danger of it is I get criticized for buying their propaganda, you know, or for somehow playing into their hand, you know. And so there's a balance there, you know, that has to be weighed with. Wright's thesis that they essentially wanted to draw us into Afghanistan, I find that so pertinent now because look at the debate that's happened after the Jordanian pilot was killed. There were pieces written about how, you know, how ISIS is the clear loser in this. You know, they killed the Jordanian pilot and they didn't get this woman that they were trying to trade, etc.
Right.
I'm of the opinion that they actually won. And the reason I think they won is with every one of these horrific videos that they're putting out, they're succeeding in recruiting more people to their crazy cause. And I actually believe that they're trying to poke the hornet's nest. I think they want us to send in ground troops.
Yeah.
I think they want us to be there to have, you know, this mythical battle that they believe is going to happen at the end of time.
Yeah.
How else do you explain that they killed James Foley allegedly in retaliation for the airstrikes? the airstrikes get worse, and they keep on killing them, you know? And, I mean, in these open and very sort of public spectacles, I mean, I can't prove it, but I think Wright's thesis holds true even today.
Well, it seems like the thing that has shifted is, whereas that was a sort of, hey, this is a kind of secret strategy that, like, you might figure out later, it's now like,
yeah,
put this in your, like, newspapers and your TVs. Like, do it now.
Right.
You know? The media element is no longer veiled
exactly.
at all.
Like, exactly.
So when you're reporting that, when you're reporting on the death of this Jordanian pilot, and a big part of that story is this was intended for the media. Like, this was mailed to mm-hmm. me. As from what I understand, there was, like, potentially additional flames photoshopped into, like...
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think that's maybe controversial. Some people think the fire looks fake.
Looks fake.
In parts of it.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
What I'm interested in is when you're covering that Jordanian pilot,
yeah.
and a big part of it is this was sent to the media, mm-hmm. do you include that in your story? Like, that this is an act aimed at the media?
I haven't included it as that specifically before, but I've tried to address the recruitment element. You mm-hmm. know, that with every one of these atrocities, you know, they seem to be getting more Twitter hits,
yep.
more Facebook likes, you know, all of the social media metrics that one looks for sort of a budding company, you know, that is yep. trying to emerge on the market. Fox News put out the entire unedited footage of the immolation of the pilot. Very controversial. I saw them, you know, sort of being pilloried on Twitter. There's an interesting discussion to have, you know, around that. The photo editor, David Furst, at on the international desk of the New York Times, his stance has been that you show the hostage in, you know, whatever images we have of them pre-capture to kind of maintain their dignity. And whatever images are shown of the execution are going to be the most dignified ones. You know, not the knife to the neck,
right.
not the flames, but the man in the, you know, in the cage, just, you know, looking down in the moments.
Stoic.
Before his death, stoic, exactly. On what Fox News did, the one interesting element of that is I have a certain perspective on the Islamic State. And I happen to think that they're very dangerous. I happen to think that they continue even now to be underestimated. I think we continue to think, oh, well, this is just propaganda. Oh, they don't mean it. Oh, whatever. And the reason I have that perspective is because I'm watching these horrific videos several times a week.
Yeah.
Right? We don't even report on the locals being killed. You know,
right.
the homosexual man, allegedly homosexual man, who's thrown off of a building, you know,
right.
and who doesn't die and then gets beaten up on top of it. The line of Syrian soldiers from Assad's regime who get beheaded in a mass execution. The stonings.
Yeah. They're overpublishing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but they're so awful. They're
yeah.
so horrific. And I do think that if other people were able to see that as much as I am, mm-hmm. that perhaps our foreign policy would be different. Because I think we're not really reckoning yet with the true depth of this organization, and excuse me for saying, but the true evil, you know,
yeah.
of this group.
Well, I'm interested in how you can depict that to an audience. I mean, it feels to me like there's maybe three players in these countries. You have the soldiers, many of whom are foreign or have ended up on circuitous paths to where they are. And then you have the leadership, which has generally been involved in this longer. And then you have the ordinary civilians who are trapped. I mean, and when I say these foot soldiers and the leaders, I could be talking about 25 different groups
right.
from regime groups to yeah. different splinter groups. But there are all of these players. How do you decide what's an important story among that? I mean, do you think I need a story about civilians for every story I have about the leadership? What's the balance
well,
there?
I mean, for me, part of it is that my beat is circumscribed as and is described as, you know, Islamic extremism, terrorism, ISIS, Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
I have a very competent set of colleagues in the Middle East, in Lebanon, in Turkey,
yeah.
et cetera, that are covering the actual Syrian conflict. So everything dealing with civilians has sort of is their turf. And,
ah, okay.
and it wouldn't necessarily be right for me to be doing.
Are you the only one on the ISIS desk right now?
You know, the ISIS desk has become very collaborative because we're obviously, you know, we're obviously
need a bigger office now.
Yeah, it was sort of a lonely beat for a while back when it was still called the JV team. But I mean, now, you know, when these big stories happen, all of us are pooling string. You know, we have the Jordanian pilot was an example where we had an actual staffer and two freelancers in Jordan who were, you know, following the family, getting confirmation from government officials. We have our actual bureau in Beirut in Lebanon that is dealing with the Syria situation. We have staffers in Turkey at the Kobani border, and all of us are just trying, you know, through every source that we have to confirm, is he really dead? Is he going to be killed? There was a moment in time where people were tweeting that the Jordanians had agreed to trade Sadija, this Iraqi would-be suicide bomber, and that they were in the process of moving her to the border.
Yeah.
You know, so you can spend hours just chasing chasing those kind of things from every single angle, you know, that you have, asking every single person that you know.
Well, I'm curious, like, who are all these people that you know, and like, who are these sources?
You know, on the ISIS beat, first of all, it's not a huge amount of people, and they've shifted. I started out, there was one guy who did describe himself as an ISIS member. He was Turkish. And I was talking to him when I was still living in West Africa, and he was almost like a savant. I mean, he would send me Anwar al-Awlaki's, you know, speeches on various points about martyrdom missions, you know, trying to explain to me the theological underpinnings of why a suicide bomber is okay in Islam. And
that's to try to convince you of his viewpoint?
Yeah, and I mean, to be able to talk to these people in light of what they do, I have to sort of put part of my brain on a shelf.
Right.
The female side of me has to completely shut up because, I mean, there's just no talking about, you know, about the role of women in this particular interpretation of Islam. I just can't go there. You know, it viscerally upsets me. so there's certain topics that I just don't even go near. And so instead, we open the discussion by, well, can you explain, I'm always asking, can you explain why are you doing X, you know? And then he feels like an instructor and is sending me links to read and, you know, citations from the Quran. One of the sources I had told me the specific English language translation of the Quran that he wanted me to buy. I went ahead and bought it. You know, we would sit there and kind of have like joint readings where he'd be like, well, do you see in this particular scripture how it talks about this particular type of retribution? The occupational hazard of this particular beat is that sources get killed.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you got a few, that's like...
I mean, I had this one guy, Umar Ould-Humaha, that not just me, but a lot of people, you know, spoke to in Mali, and he got killed in the middle of 2013. He was extremely useful to me before then, and he even helped me try to understand ISIS, you know, type things, because these guys are sort of in touch with each other. I then had this Turkish guy who I believe has been killed because we were talking on the order of, I mean, we would, you know, have 15 to 20 messages every day, you know, Facebook, etc., you know, with, you know, questions, links, blah, blah, blah. And then from one day to the next, he completely disappeared. And we'd never had sort of like a falling out of any kind.
He's just not into you. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And then for a while, I was sort of flailing there for a time. And then another person, you know, surfaces.
Right.
They often ask me to follow them on Twitter, and then they try to take the conversation to another platform. They used to be using this thing called Kik, K-I-K. For some reason, this was popular with them for a while. For another period of time, they were using WhatsApp, and they just keep on moving from platform to platform. So, strangely, a lot of the sources I've had recently were people that I ended up getting into fights with on Twitter. And then eventually, you know, they're insulting me, kufar, kufar, infidel, infidel, you know, the stupid infidel woman, you know, like, you have no idea. And then somehow, you know, the ice is broken and they'll ask me to follow them, which I already have. And then they follow me. And then suddenly we're messaging each other directly.
Because I actually looked at your Twitter this morning and you were like arguing with people about this.
I'm always arguing with them.
And I noticed actually the topic today, I'm not exposing any things, is on Twitter. If you go in there, it's people who are like, don't you know ISIS are liars? And you go, actually, I don't agree with that statement. Here's why. And then people, you know, there's like, you stupid woman.
Exactly.
And I was like, why is she engaging with these people?
I know. I keep on expecting the FBI to call me one day and go, you know, what the heck, you know? But
yeah, I mean, so Okay, well, I know you can't disclose anything about current sources, but let's talk about some of these sources who are not with us, so therefore not in any danger at all.
Right.
So like a source like Omar was...
Umar Ultramaha.
Why did he get in touch and how?
So he was on the phone. He was actually... I would actually call him and text him. And he was basically an emir of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And he became sort of the self-appointed spokesman that would talk to reporters. He's been quoted by the New York Times. He's been quoted by Reuters. He's been quoted by AP.
So his colleagues knew that he was talking to the New York Times.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Are some of these people secret about it and not public that they're talking to reporters?
I'm sure.
Okay.
I'm sure. And the thing that has been somehow sometimes difficult for me to even explain to editors is I can't quote these people because I don't actually know who they are.
Right.
You know, like I don't know their real identity. One in particular, I know that he is, that he has a role in what's called the media committee of one of the terrorist groups that we cover. And I know this from other people. Other people have contacted me and who have multiple sources who have told me this, right? But even then, it's kind of flaky. I mean, because I don't know what their real name is.
Right.
All I know is these are people that have access to genuine Al-Qaeda or ISIS statements hours before they go public. That to me is a test. You know, you have access to a password protected website that very few people have access to, or you have access to kind of raw intel that, for example, one particular source messaged me at the very end of last year, I think it was December, just a few days before the new year, and she said, this pilot has been captured, and my sources in Raqqa are saying that he's been tortured and interrogated. And in the interrogation, they got some very interesting stuff out of him, including operations and how, you know, how the coalition is carrying out airstrikes. And I'll have to go back and look at the date, but it was just days after that they came out in, I believe it was in their English language magazine, with this glossy, you know, multi-page spread on the interrogation that they had done with this guy. You know, so you have that interaction enough times and you start to, the first time you don't believe it, you know, maybe it's just a coincidence. But after a certain time, you realize, okay, this person who I don't know who they are does somehow have a real channel to whoever is putting out the real propaganda. And they're very useful because they're telling me what's coming.
And so part of this is sort of a coordinated media strategy.
Like
there's the guys who are like putting out the DVD.
Yeah.
And then there's a guy who's kind of like bootlegging the DVD and putting it up like a day early and sending it to you.
Yeah.
But the intention was still put that DVD out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm assuming that ISIS must also have secrets, which is to say things that they do not want people to know about.
Yeah.
Are your sources primarily pro-ISIS people? I mean, are there dissidents who are leaking ISIS material they shouldn't also?
I have one person who appears to be a dissident. They just sent me a message saying that they're retiring, which I'm very upset about. This person had sort of very much imbibed the ideology on many points, but was very turned off by the Yazidi sex slave issue.
Right.
That was a line that this person felt should not have been crossed. And at first, they were just actively contacting me, and they wanted me to write about the Yazidis, sort of a month before that height of stories started hitting the internet with, you know, various Yazidi women giving interviews about their captivity and stuff. And unfortunately, it was sort of off of my beat. You know, like I'm dealing with terrorism, and I was very involved with the hostage reporting, so it was just not for me, you know, to do that. The source then became very frustrated because, you know, they're like telling me all of these things about like what's happening with the Yazidis and stuff. And then I believe went to other reporters, you know, and sort of disappeared for a while and then resurfaced. So it's a sort of unpredictable kind of stream of information. And you have to strike a balance between being nice enough to these people that they would want to talk to you. You know, you can't be an asshole to them and be like, you're a terrorist, whatever, and sound very, you know, kind of accusatorial. At the same time, I don't shy away from telling them, if they ask me, what my opinion is, you know, of what they're doing. I had a conversation with one particular person in Al-Qaeda where I said to him, you know, look, man, like, I'm practically a vegetarian. I think that killing an animal, you know, is to me problematic. And certainly killing civilians. I do not agree with what you're doing, okay? But at the same time, I'm a journalist and I want to do my job well, and I think that it's very important for us to understand your point of view as well as we can, right? I think because of the fact that these groups, because by nature they're secret, you know, and by nature in general reporters cannot contact them to have their reply. which is the cardinal rule of how we report on almost every other thing. You know, like you cover a murder, you call the murderer's lawyer, you know, to get their say about the, you know, the conviction, the sentencing, whatever. You don't ever do a story in almost every other realm that we cover where you only state one side.
Right.
And because of that, I think there's a lot of incorrect reporting. It's the one group you can say just about anything about because those people will never call you out.
Right.
They'll never call your editors. They don't know how.
Right.
An interesting example last year where before the Yazidi sex slave thing, a member of the UN, I believe it was in Iraq. I'm a little fuzzy on the details, but I believe it was a UN official in Iraq announced that ISIS had begun a campaign in various provinces in Iraq to do female genital cutting. And several media houses, you know, ran with it. It was a UN official who was saying it, right? So I have some sympathy, you know, for them. It was completely wrong. Completely wrong. They don't, in fact, ISIS does not believe in FGM, right? And they came, it's been something that they have used over and over again
FGM
as an example.
FGM is kind of like a regional practice more than a religious practice.
Completely. Yeah. And there's been, in fact, there's been stories done, like in East Africa, about imams being, you know, being essentially brought in by the UN and other agencies to try to explain that this is not a religious edict. It's a completely cultural practice in Egypt and in West Africa, etc. Somalia.
Yeah, right.
So basically the idea was, I mean, people just ran with it because, you know, of course, ISIS, this murderous death cult, awful people, they also surely have done this awful thing too.
Right.
You know, and they hate women on top of it, you know. But it was completely false. That's the kind of mistakes that get made, I believe, quite frequently, because we can't really call them, you know, to be
right.
Like, okay, spokesman of ISIS, can you please tell me, is this true, is this not true?
And I've actually been surprised with how open they are with the media. I'm surprised yeah. that there isn't like a live interview
yeah.
call where like, you know, the head of ISIS does like a check-in. I mean, it's that constant enough communication
yeah.
that it wouldn't seem out of bounds
for them to
for
do that.
People to be on air via satellite in the near future.
That's true. They were doing it in Mali. In Mali, you literally could call Umar al-Hamaha or this other guy called Sanda ul-Bumana to, you know, to get their spiel on. Did you destroy the ancient mausoleums of Timbuktu? Of course we did. Of course. You know, here's the Sharia ruling for why we did it. You know, you could do that there. Perhaps because ISIS is more on the radar of a group that people are trying to hunt down.
Right. So what do these sources think of you? I mean, you're a woman who is dealing with men who are soldiers and, you know, your name's on the front of the newspaper. What do they make of a female reporter?
I mean, the ones that I get on the best with are surprisingly kind to me and complimentary. They call me out when I've made mistakes. For example, in Mali after the French invasion, this was just at the start where ISIS was kind of just like a, you know, an embryo and the whole Twitter thing hadn't really taken off. But these various terrorist groups, what they were doing is they were creating Twitter accounts. And it was before Twitter was shutting them all down. So there was one, you know, where you go there and you'd see like 10,000 followers, all of them journalists.
Right.
And so what I did is I reached out to one of these groups. I said, can you please follow me? Whatever. They didn't follow me, but I suddenly got a message. This other guy that had, you know, this very jihadist kind of picture. It was a dude on a horse, completely in black, with a sword that was dripping blood.
It's important to use the right iconography.
So he suddenly appears and then he clearly put this in Google Translate. In broken English, he says to me, please follow. You know, please follow me, something like that. So I followed him, and he then introduces himself as the webmaster of the Twitter account for Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. And we start chatting. And he was interviewed. I can't remember what he did this with a few reporters. And he then got disillusioned because I can't remember if it was the Wall Street Journal. It was some reporter essentially like interviewed him in these direct messages on Twitter and then published a little story that he felt was unfair because he didn't realize, he didn't think he was being interviewed. You know, he thought he was just sharing,
right.
sharing tweets, you know, with a reporter. And anyway, and so he, you know, he contacted me and, you know, was very upset about this. And I was like, listen, like, I mean, these people have editors, you know, you can complain if you want, you know, like, I mean, I'm not sure that they'll take you seriously, but, you know, like if this was an off the record interview, you know, this is kind of a right that you have, you know, with a journalist. He said, okay, I didn't know that, whatever. A little bit later, like a few months later, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb put out a statement. And I did a story on it, and I made a mistake. I somehow misread and made an assumption that was incorrect. And he contacted me, and he was a little bit angry, and he said, Rukmini, you know, you made a mistake on this. And this was what sealed our relationship, or our, you know, journalist-source kind of relationship. I looked at the statement. I looked at what I wrote. I realized I'd made a mistake, and I immediately did a correction. And then I sent him the correction, and I sent him the new material, and I said, look, here it is. You know, this is the new thing. And that was sort of a watershed moment, you know, for him, because I think he then realized, okay, I'm not just here to, you know, put out whatever the heck I want to put out, you know, about this group. If I've made a mistake, I've made a mistake. You know, like, I mean, we all make mistakes, right? And I'm perfectly happy to own it. He then started, you know, being very nice to me, and he would say, Rukmini, you're different than the other journalists.
Yeah.
And he was also very when he would be unhappy with some of my coverage, he would scold me in a way that it almost felt like a parent, you know, like I'm disappointed in you, kind of thing. Yeah. And among the things that really upset him, and I've actually tried to change this because I'm not sure that the word adds that much, it upset him very much that we called him terrorists. So I've tried as much as I can, you know, to kind of take that word out when I can. Let's call them militants, extremists. You know, the terrorist word is very loaded, and I will talk about terrorism, and I will talk about terror acts, but I'm trying to lessen the use of the noun.
Right.
I think that's a fair practice. You know,
right.
I think, you know, even like in the Israel, you know, context, numerous news organizations have stopped using the word terrorist to refer to Palestinian militants and extremists, right? Anyway, so it's these kind of things where I'm trying very hard to show them that I intend to treat them fairly to the extent that I can. You know, I mean, we will never shy away from writing what is the truth, which is that these are acts of atrocity, that these are gross violations of human rights.
So you've been based out of West Africa for quite a while. I want to talk about how you ended up there, but do you feel uncomfortable that ISIS knows who you are and what your name is and what you look like? I mean, does that restrict your travel at all, or do you feel like you're on neutral terms with them?
I'm not totally sure that ISIS knows who I am.
Really?
I mean, I'm not sure.
You don't think they go on, like, NewYorkTimes.com and go, like, it's always her who's writing about us? So, like,
I think there's a bunch of us writing about them.
Okay.
And, I mean, I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe I'm deluding myself and thinking that they're not necessarily keeping as close of tabs on us.
I would have thought that might be true, like, when you were working for the AP and, like, it's getting syndicated
and it's hard
to tell who commissioned it.
But right.
Far be it for me to know who reads nytimes.com or not. I guess you could look at some IP addresses and see if it's being checked out. But even me as a casual reader, I notice that all of the stories of this type are written by you. You're the voice of the New York Times on the topic of ISIS.
I see.
Which I would just assume that someone who was a group that was so media aware would be like, she's right at the top of our Rolodex here. Like, we get her first, you know?
The reality, Aaron, is that I feel that we can't even go anywhere near ISIS territory now, certainly not in Syria. The only parts of Syria where New York Times staffers have been, you know, in the past year have been in government-controlled areas. I think right now that it would be suicidal, not just for me, but for anybody, to go into an ISIS-controlled area, regardless of the sort of protection that you might have. And as the stories of these hostages, you know, come out, more and more we keep on seeing people that trusted another rebel group or a fixer or whatever, but also, you know, these rebel groups that are supposed to be somewhat secular and were given assurances, etc. And I believe this is what happened with one of the Japanese, you know, hostages. And then either, you know, we don't really know how they're taken, but either they're ambushed or they're sold, or, you know, or something else, something in between, you know, happens, and they end up, you know, in ISIS hands. There's been essentially two reporters that have gone and been able to operate inside of ISIS territory openly and with their permission. There was one from Vice. I believe he's a Muslim man, and I believe he's a Sunni. Right. So, I mean, I can't even compare myself. You know.
Right. I think, and I believe he actually shot that video, not even as a representative of Vice and then sold it to Vice. So he was not even
on contract.
He was
with
not
them.
On.
Right.
He was freelancing right. when he shot that video.
Right, right. They've held that up, that Vice footage. They've held that up over and over again as an example of, you know, we don't actually hate reporters. You know, we just hate the ones that are agents of the coalition. You know, and of the evil crusader government.
Right.
So there's been that, and then more recently there was this German author. Excuse me for saying this, but I don't want to call him a journalist because in our definition of journalism, he's more of an activist, right? But you know, kudos to him. He managed to, over months and months, working probably in a similar way to I am through social media, contacted various channels. They gave him a letter, which was then posted on the internet, assuring his protection. And they allowed him in, I think, for a couple of weeks. And he came out and did sort of these amazingly, scintillating sort of takes on what it was like to be inside ISIS-controlled areas. He described, one thing that stayed with me is he described how at this one recruitment building that he visited, how these, dozens of recruits were showing up practically every day with just this shine in their eyes, you know, this excitement about being able to be part of the Islamic State. So they've now held up this guy, you know, as yet another example of, oh, we don't really hate journalists, you know?
Right. Well, it's kind of like the Chris Christie investigation into Bridgegate. Like, it's, you know, it's like,
right.
it's like we found, like, the perfect person to run this. But I'm interested, are you relying on people who are on the ground, like in the territory surrounding ISIS territory in your reporting?
I have one source who claims that he is inside.
Yeah.
I don't actually know who he is.
Right.
Because I don't plan to quote him at any point. You know, I'm using him as a resource to understand. I have refrained from asking him who he is because I know that will just make him uncomfortable, you know, and will possibly make him shut down, you know, on me. Whether he's really there or not, you know, who knows? What is useful to me is he sends me these official messages an hour or more before they usually start being disseminated on a large scale. But as far as my own security, I mean, there's been some recent reporting. The U.S. Embassy and others have made this clear that ISIS now, because they're very low on hostages or internationally prominent hostages, that they're actually trying to look in neighboring countries. Among them is southern Turkey. And I was in southern Turkey with colleagues in November and December.
This is near the border to Syria.
Yes. There's the town of Antakya, there's the town of Urfa, and the town of Gaziantep, all of which are within a short driving distance of the border, and all of which are, you know, kind of a maze of neighborhoods that have very large Syrian incoming migrants.
And are also serving as a transfer port for people who are trying to join
the whole
motley crew of interests in them.
Yeah, exactly. And there's an entire industry of fixers that are there and that peddle ISIS defectors and also sometimes real members of ISIS to members of the media. I've done a couple of these interviews. They're hard to do because it's so hard to vet any of this information. You know, I mean, you speak to a guy who claims that he's an interrogator for ISIS. How do I vet his information? Is there a second source who can tell me that what he's telling me is correct? I don't know. But given that those people, let's imagine that they're real, that they're opening, that they're meeting me in a mall. You know, imagine that they're able to do that as ISIS members. It means that they have full access, you know, to this part of Turkey. And there's now increasing warnings that they're looking for Western journalists to kidnap. I have a very good friend, a very experienced reporter who has years and years of experience in the Middle East and who speaks fluent Arabic. And she described being told by a very close source of hers that they were going around with her picture among ISIS members, and that they were actively looking for her. She's a person that has a very large social media following, so, you know, if she was kidnapped, it would be a big deal. Anyway, so there's stories of that kind that are coming out and that are very worrisome, you know, and that, you know, now there's reports that they're working with Turkish smugglers who allegedly are looking for journalists or civilians, you know, to capture and who will then, I guess, sell them, you know, to ISIS.
This episode is going to be terrible for the Turkish tourism industry.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And anyway, so it was my first time to this region. You know, I've never actually been to Syria because I came onto this beat essentially in 2014, in 2013, I was still covering Mali.
Yeah.
And I came onto it at a point in time when there were almost 24 Western hostages that were already being held. And it was very clear that this, I mean, unless you have a death wish, you don't go into this area.
Yeah, well, it seems like almost like this year that you've spent reporting, I don't know when if it's maybe a little bit more than a year now or...
It's less than a year.
Less than a year. Yeah.
I know.
A lot has happened. I mean, this has gone from sort of a side note story to probably like one of the biggest stories of the year. And it's all been this trajectory of this diminishing number of hostages,
yes,
which now sits at zero.
They've got John Cantley, the British guy.
Okay.
And they have one more woman who's from another country. We've been asked not to identify the country.
Okay.
But it's not the kind of country that would get the kind of publicity that the other hostages have gotten. So they have those two. It seems that Cantley, I pray for his sake, that he seems to have moved into this safer territory where they're using him for propaganda, and perhaps they've decided that that's a more useful role for him. I don't think they're actively threatening his life the way they were before, so I wonder whether he's going to be spared.
Yeah.
So that leaves him with this woman. And with the woman, I think there's still this debate within ISIS. This is what my sources tell me, that there's very much a question about whether, even for ISIS, whether that would be going too far. First of all, do you have a man execute a woman?
Right.
We heard reports. I mean, we were never able to like actually publish this because it was, you know, single source or from unreliable people, that they were training Somali girls who were new recruits, wives of fighters, to behead women. Who the heck knows? But, you know, that it was as if they were trying to answer this problem,
right,
of how do you execute a woman? Because the visuals of a man standing over an unarmed woman and, yeah, doing what they've done to these other hostages is just so awful, you know, that perhaps even for them, it's too much. So if you put these two hostages sort of out of play, and I'm not aware of any others that are with ISIS, then what they need to do is go replenish the pot. And where can they go? Southern Turkey. There's reports of Jordan. CNN had a story recently where they were quoting unnamed sources saying that they had ISIS linked, you know, agents who were looking in possibly in Jordan. So now we're in this very treacherous landscape where, in part through our own reporting on these incidences, the biggest prize is a journalist. Because as soon as you put that person's video up, everybody will write about it. I mean, just think of the coverage that James Foley's death got. Somebody quoted a poll to me recently where they were polling people, and other than 9/11, there was no event in recent, you know, world history that had such penetration. I think it was 9 out of 10 Americans responded that they had either seen the visuals or were aware of James Foley's execution. That's a huge win, you know, for them. That's what they want. And so I think in their minds, they've realized it's not just civilians, it's journalists that are, you know, the crème de la crème as far as targets. And that's a really scary thing for our profession.
Well, it's a scary thought to be sort of restarting the cycle over again, you know, assuming, yeah, that is sort of the point that they've hit. And you wonder, how can it go differently this time, assuming that people are kidnapped and,
yeah,
that there is sort of another countdown and,
yeah,
another set of scenarios in that way?
Right.
You know, the media is not a government. Like, the U.S. government can say, we're not paying ransoms.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
The media can't say,
we're not
reporting, yeah, on kidnapped journalists.
Exactly.
If enough journalists were kidnapped, I assume that there would be discussions of that kind, even if they weren't a blanket ban, in the same way that certain people chose not to report on the Snowden stuff, like categorically, we're coming out in front of it and saying, we're not going to report on these leaked documents. I mean, have there ever been discussions of that kind?
Well, I mean, I think the first discussion that has occurred is there's basically this understanding in most newsrooms that when any civilian, it's not just journalists, but when any civilian is now taken, that the blackout is respected. And, you know, this is somewhat controversial because I've spoken to, for instance, former Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who was in Afghanistan at the time when my former New York Times colleague David Rode was taken, and he was very critical of the way the Times handled it because he felt that we gave. Obviously, David Rode was a New York Times employee, right? So the paper was in this difficult situation. Like, this, surely they're not going to report on their own staffer who's been taken if that person's wife is requesting a blackout. In interviews, Galbraith felt that there was a double standard, you know, that the media was treating reporters and reporter captives differently than we had treated kidnapped diplomats, etc. I was not, you know, I was not covering this beat back then, so I don't actually know if there was a double standard. But it seems now, not just reporters, but civilians of any kind, it's sort of in the family's hands. You know, if the family decides to go public, we do. Or secondly, if ISIS, you know, once the terrorist group breaks the sort of embargo, then we report on it. But we don't report before. And this remains, to me, a very problematic and controversial decision. Because one can argue that the blackout helps the U.S. government.
Right.
I mean, nobody knew of James Foley. I mean, actually, some people did know of James Foley because his parents had done a little bit of media before the major event of his killing. But nobody knew the extent of his plight. You know, nobody knew that he'd been waterboarded, that he'd been tortured. You know, the details of this sordid, awful captivity. And one wonders if had those things been known very early on, and certainly other reporters knew it because some of his European cellmates were being released and they were coming out with these incredibly graphic descriptions of what was going on inside. What seems to have happened, and I've reported at length about this, is that the U.S. government sort of treated this as kind of a low-level priority up until Foley's execution. They almost treated it like a domestic kidnapping. And they continue to say that they did everything in their power to get him out. Yes, there was.
Except ransoming him.
except ransoming him. But there was indeed an unsuccessful raid in July, just a month and a half or so before his death. But at that point, Foley had been held for almost 2 years.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you're allowing these people to kind of rot in a jail for a really long time, which is a very different way than I think European governments handle these kind of crises. And one can argue that the blackout essentially helps officials who are trying to cover their rear ends, you know, who want to maintain this fiction that everything was done to save this human being.
And Rode later is critical of the U.S. government's decision not to offer ransoms. And you can see that blacking things out prevents a true public discussion of ransom
course.
Until it's like, well, too late now. We can't have that discussion now. Like
yeah.
The discussions of ransoming prisoners is all in retrospect at a point when it's purely theoretical, basically. Do you have people within the government also telling you don't publish things?
Always. always.
I mean, do you keep a second cell phone in your pocket to hear from the government? Like, when do they call? Like, when do you hear from them?
You know, they don't even call me. They go straight over my head to, they know exactly who to go to.
Can't even get the respect of a phone call.
Right. I mean, even yesterday, ISIS comes out and announces that Kayla's dead, and they include in their first initial kind of release all of these identifying details, her first name, her last name, which I knew, her middle name, which I did not know, her former telephone number in Turkey, her address in Prescott, Arizona. I knew she was from Arizona. I did not actually know what town she was from. And they did that, I think, because they're not showing a body. And so they're trying to kind of provide all of the details to show, well, we really had her. So in the first couple takes of the story that we put up on the web, we did not name her. Even though the Washington Post and others did. And the discussion I had with, you know, with my editors at the time was, why do we want to get out in front of this? She's named, and this is going to come out pretty soon, next couple hours. Why don't we just wait for the family, you know, to do whatever they're going to do? And sure enough, I believe it was by afternoon, the family put out a statement where they themselves, you know, confirmed her captivity. And at that point, you know, we named her. But it's this awful balance between our duty as reporters, you know, our duty, you know, in maintaining transparency about what's happening, and the very real fear that mentioning, you know, these people, that, you know, displaying the conditions of their detention might bring harm to them.
And that was part one of my interview with Rukmini Kalimaki. We will have the second part of that interview up as soon as we can. This one was edited by Jenna Weiss Berman. Our intern is Rachel Mabe. My co-hosts are Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky. Our sponsors were tinyletter and lynda.com, where if you go to lynda.com/longform, you can get a 10-day free trial to everything at lynda.com. Thank you very much to Rukmini Kalamhaki for talking to me long enough to justify 2 episodes. Charge your phones, get your earbuds ready. We'll have part 2 out very soon.